and I enjoyed that. The NSF also has another thing going for it. It has always had a rather good staff. And the policy of bringing in rotators has really served the foundation very, very well. Now, they don't do as many rotators today as they used to, and I think that's a mistake. I really like the idea of rotators, at least a fairly... You don't want everybody to be a rotator, I'm not suggesting that, but to have a fairly decent number of rotators in all of the research programs that come and stay 1 or 2 years, or 3 years at most, I think that's really a very, very good mechanism, because it brings new blood in and brings new ideas in and so on.
And it's educational for the rotators.
Oh, is it ever? I mean, they learn, they take back as much information. The problem is it's hard to get some of the best scientists to do it because they see it as a break in their career and they see it as time out of their creative juices and what have you, which is kind of a shame in a way. You really would like to see some of the very best people go. And it's always been difficult to get some of the very best people even to take the direct, you know, to take the assistant directorships too, or the division chairs and what have you. But on balance, I think the NSF has been able to get rather good people. And certainly the 80s was an interesting time for research and development. Through that period, support for R&D was pretty bipartisan in nature. There wasn't much quarrel. It was just a question of how much people thought they could afford and what have you. Then in 1991, President Bush offered me a position on PCAST, which is the President's Council of Advisors for Science and Technology. And Alan Bromley was the chair of that. You remember, he was the science advisor to Bush. And so I did accept that, and then I resigned from the foundation board a year before my term to take that PCAST appointment. And that was that was kind of fun, a meeting over there in the old executive office building with Alan Bromley, who is a very energetic guy anyway. And we actually did get a few things done, I thought. We got, for the first time ever, the president put out a document that actually said technology policy on it. They'd never been able to get a policy statement of any kind there out. And that was the time also that a couple of new programs got started. Bush pushed the advanced technology program, and Bromley certainly did. It started, you remember, with only about $10 million. But as a way to begin to connect the research base to the technology base, and I still think those are extraordinarily good programs.
Well, all the while you were serving on the National Science Board and now in this new office, you were still research director at Allied Signals.
Right.
How much time out of your paid employment did these public positions take?
Oh, they take more than you have. Okay, but you just sort of do the best you can. Those positions in the industry today at that level simply take however much time you have. I mean, there is no such thing as a normal work day. It just doesn't happen. And so you learn how to manage those interactions. And, you know, there are times when there's just conflicts and you have to resolve it in favor of the company. It turned out that being chairman wasn't such a bad deal because I could actually, and there was two reasons for it. One was that we had an extraordinarily good person who was the staff director for the board at NSF. And if you've got good staff, you can manage these things. It really is that simple. If you've got poor staff, it's a disaster if you've got to try to do each and every minute of it yourself. But we had good staff. Secondly, the company was very gracious to provide me with support. In other words, I could use a couple of my administrative people and to help and that sort of thing. What the country doesn't understand is that we've gotten ourselves now into these conflict of interest positions where it's very hard for people who work in the industry to be in these positions today. And that is a real shame because the input back and forth is excellent. And not only that, but you know, the Allied Signal didn't get much out of me being chairman of the National Science Board. You know what I'm saying? On the other hand, they as a private, as a public service kind of a thing, were pleased that you got the visibility. That meant something to them. But they were perfectly willing to, you know, to give you support and all that kind of thing, which turns out to be quite a bit of contribution. But by doing that, you can make it happen. And on occasion, I would get folks to come up to Morristown. It's not that far, rather than me making the trek down there. And you can make it work, but it's not easy to do. And a lot of people really don't want to do it because it is a burden on top of. I mean, the company, on the other hand, gives you no slack on your job.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they think this is wonderful. Fine, carry on. As long as it doesn't interfere.
Just do it instead of sleeping.
Yeah, right. As long as it doesn't interfere with what I need. It's doable, but it's tough to do. I was fortunate because my husband's very supportive of these sort of nutty ideas, and that's a big help as well. And if that were not the case, I don't think it would be possible, to be honest.
Then you got persuaded to really shift into the public sector, the government.
Yeah, that is true. When I was asked to come as the Undersecretary for Technology and Commerce, I must admit that would have not been my first choice if I went into the government.
What would have been your first choice? Being president.
Well, you're much better off being science advisor or something like that. But anyway, I must say Ron Brown was very persuasive. But the real reason that you do it is none of that. There were two reasons. One was that for the first time, President Clinton and his transition team had put together a technology plan, a science and technology plan. If you remember, it's the first time ever that that's been done, to my knowledge. I mean, people have said little things, but I mean in terms of really looking at the science and technology basis being a part of what makes the country great. And this plan was really quite well done. The transition team did a very good job with it. And when you think about it, the Cold War, ending of the Cold War says, and as it has now been borne out, that the Defense Department's support of R&D is going to continue to diminish. And indeed, that's our biggest problem at the moment, is that we've lost that fundamental kind of work that was supported by defense, and no one has picked that up. And that's why you have this big disparity right now between NIH, which continues to get funded because there's good rapport in the Congress for it, at the same time that you have a reducing support for engineering and the physical sciences. But a big chunk of that used to come out of the Department of Defense, because you remember the people at even LSU who had support from the Air Force and from the Navy and whatever. And that's all drying up. And so you now have the... And so when you think about that, civilian technology is now... Somehow you've got to elevate the concept of civilian technology and civilian science that underpins that in such a way that you can get that civilian stuff funded in the same way that you used to get it funded under the defense rubric. And that's, we haven't done that yet. But the opportunity to be in a position to articulate that. And the other issue really was that, you know, I had been extraordinarily fortunate in my career and the things that I'd been able to do, and it was an opportunity to try to give some of that back. I know that sounds trite, but it really isn't.
No, it sounds more inspirational than trite. I was just wondering, what was the particular persuasive argument that Ron Brown used?
Two things. One was that he fully agreed with the president's technology, science and technology plan. He thought it was, and not only that, but he believed that the whole commercial and issues that are associated with commerce depended on it. That if the country was to grow, you had to have that base, and he understood that. And the second piece that he used to get you was that you can pick your own people. And he meant that. I was never forced to take a single political appointee I didn't want. I got to interview them. They sent me people they wanted me to interview, which was fine. But I didn't have to take anybody that I didn't want who didn't fit what I wanted to do.
Did anyone from Allied Signal move with you?
No, we didn't. The person that I would have moved if I could have would have been my secretary. But she lived in Morristown and was pretty close to retirement anyway, so it wasn't feasible to do. Right, but no, since then, a couple of people have come. One of the guys that used to report to me is now running the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, because he was very, very knowledgeable about our whole automotive division and so forth, and so we needed a... In fact, I hired two Allied Signal people to do that. The first one that I hired to do it had been in the Washington office of Allied Signal. The first guy that I got to come and manage that program because he knew about how to work the government, and then the second one came from Allied Signal as well. But other than that, no, we didn't.
In your role as Undersecretary for Technology in the Department of Commerce, you were called on to make a number of significant speeches or addresses.
I thought you'd like to see that.
Whose titles are impressive. Can you tell me something about some of those?
Well, it turns out that, you know, if you look at them, the content of those things are pretty much the same, in the sense that what we were trying to argue was that, first of all, the country needs a science and technology policy that it can articulate so that the public can understand it and be willing to make it a priority to pay for it. The second was to generate some understanding of what the federal support of R&D in the past has meant to the country. We put together two or three documents that I'm really right proud of on that. One was Technology in the National Interest, which really outlines that whole business about, you know, where what the government support has meant. For example, things like the internet wouldn't have existed today without the support that came out of defense and NSF. Semiconductors, all of that was started with government money. I mean, you know, things that we take for granted were really nurtured with government money early on. And clearly the biotechnology revolution in the United States is totally dependent upon the NIH budget and wouldn't be here had we not spent that kind of money. And so the whole issue, what we tried to do in that office and the Office of Technology Policy, was to get people to understand the fact that technology today, and by definition the science that supports it, really is the basis on which you're going to compete in the next century. Those countries that have it will compete, those that don't won't. It's really not very complex. And secondly, that support for R&D for civilian technology is as serious as the support for R&D for defense technology was in 1960. And thirdly, that you've got to be willing to spread it across a fairly broad range of disciplines, because I can't predict for you where the next major commercial breakthrough is likely to come. I need to have a portfolio of things. Now, I'm not opposed to making some plan that says, you know, these are the areas in which we really need to kind of focus, but I don't want that focus down to three, which I think is very detrimental. And that was going very well. We were really making quite good progress with those kinds of and the science advisor John Gibbons set up a new National Science and Technology Council, which brought in all of the major players, me from Commerce, the Undersecretary from Defense, the Undersecretary from DOE, Department of Energy, you know, a major player from EPA, NIH, the whole bit, to begin to have the government people talk to each other and understand, take out the duplicates, you know, try not to duplicate each other's programs, try to collaborate when you can. And the collaborative programs like the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, which was so difficult to get up and running, is a classic example of what you can do if you're willing to take the time and effort to get these groups to play together rather than everybody playing his own game. So we were, I thought, making some real progress. The 104th Congress that came in 1994, of course, took major wind out of all of our sails, because R&D was not on the agenda for that group, particularly in the House. As much as anything, in my view, is because they didn't have any clue as to why it should be. The other issue was that they came in with this anti-government mindset, which said that any interaction of the government with a company really should be prohibited, and that any development of commercial technology ought to be done by the private sector, and the government should not intervene, which is a very simplistic view of the world today. It just is not sustainable. Because they don't understand the connections, they don't know why the federal R&D feeds all of that, and without it you can't make it work. And if you're going to get the synergies and the speed out of the system, they got to have pretty decent connections between them. So we spent and the other thing was that in his technology plan, Clinton and the transition team recognized that the Department of Commerce really ought to become the advocate and so forth, and the driver for civilian technology, in the same way that defense had been the driver for defense technology. And two things happened. One was that, so therefore, programs like the Advanced Technology Program became Clinton programs, in quotation marks, and therefore targets of that 94th, of that 104th Congress. Without thinking about what was in them, they became highly political because they saw them as Clinton programs, even though ATP was started back in the Bush administration. The person who had had my job in the Bush administration had pushed it very, very hard to get it done, had pushed the legislation, had pushed all of the stuff that made it possible to do it, but that didn't seem to make any difference to them. As far as they were concerned, it was a Clinton program, and they were against it. So you ended up with at least a year and a half, almost 2 years, of very partisan politics over R&D spending. And I think we managed to just keep, don't talk about the politics, keep talking about why you have to have it, just keep making the speeches, go to the hearings, make the same speech, why you have to have it, why it's so important, why you can't exist without it. And actually, I think we prevailed, at least to some extent. We salvaged ATP. It's still there. It's about $200 million. Ought to be $500 million, but that's okay. It's still there, and it's now a regular program, hopefully. Began to get some movement in the Senate to truly begin to look at R&D and see if they couldn't move it. Fritz and from Tennessee and Bingaman and from New Mexico and Lieberman from Connecticut and Rockefeller from West Virginia in particular, and Domenici even came into the mix. The House is still confused, if you will. Although the Science Committee, and then we had Mr. Walker from Pennsylvania to contend with, and Mr. Walker had been a colleague of Newt Gingrich's back when they were in the minority, and he was one of the big pushers just to create problems to try to get a political position, and he was absolutely opposed to anything that the government might do to support technology. He told me once, I went in and spent about an hour with him, and he told me once that it was his opinion that if you cut the capital gains tax, eliminated the capital gains tax, that he would guarantee that within a year the industry would be building research laboratories on university campuses and hiring university people to do research. And I said, Congressman, I came from that community. I can assure you that's not going to happen. I don't care what you do. That's not the way it's done. It is not going to occur. He understood that, and that was his position, and that was the way it was. Which, of course, is just devastating to the whole concept of how you build a science and technology policy. But when he retired from the Congress, which everybody was relieved, to say the least, Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin is a much different person, very rational, fiscally conservative, but very much very knowledgeable about R&D and why it needs to be there. And so the last year or so has been a whole lot less political. And so we were able to make some real progress. Now, the question is whether or not it will result in any funding, and I'm not at all sure yet, to be honest with you, whether it will or not. I'm very concerned about the 99 federal R&D budget, because the president put in some nice increases and all that, but many of them were dependent upon the cigarette tax bill. And that, as you know, is pretty chaotic at the moment. How that's going to come out, I don't know. And what the Congress seems not disposed to use the money for R&D. And then you had this absolute budget-breaking highway bill, which is now there. And the reason that's important is there are caps on the discretionary spending. And all of that excess in the highway bill has to be taken out of what could have gone to R&D under those caps. And I think the caps will stay. And so there's a real possibility that in 99 that you'll get some increase for NIH, you could get a flat NSF, and you could get decreases everywhere else, which I think would be a disaster. But it's possible to do, because it just can't get up. You just can't get it up to the level of priority that it's got to have. There's beginning to, and we finally, I think, are getting the industry to begin to move to help, and that's going to have to occur, otherwise it's not going to work. But the Council on Competitiveness is moving it very well. I was up there for their summit meeting last week, and the report that's coming out of that looks very good, and you've got major CEOs in the industry now who are willing to make the argument too. But the issue was to try to reach as many groups as you could, and to try to get the message as widely distributed as you could.
Right. Well, you had appointments in Washington of one sort or another by four presidents in sequence.
Yeah.
Two Republicans bookended by two Democrats.
That's right.
Would you care to comment on the prevailing style differences among these presidents, or your experiences with them?
The thing that I know most is their approach to research and R&D
yeah.
and things like that. When Reagan first came in as president, we had a very difficult time because he brought some ideas with him that said that NSF, for example, should not fund social sciences. Part of the social conservatism. The problem you've got today is that you're fighting on the one side fiscal conservatism, which affects both the Republicans and the Democrats, for that matter. And then you've got the social conservatism that's coming in from the right side of the Republicans. And you've also got some strange philosophy coming in, frankly, from the left-wing side of the Democrats about what you shouldn't do in in things like, you know, the ethical issues of environmental things and stuff. So you put all that together, and it's been a kind of a difficult time. But when Reagan first came in, there was a very difficult time for NSF because he just flat cut all of the budget out of social sciences. And we were left with the problem of how to maintain the social science databases. Because if I can't maintain the databases, I'm going to lose continuity here, and I can't make this thing go at all, right? So what we did was we took those databases and their support, and we moved them into odd places, the board did. And we managed to salvage those. And then, of course, after a year or so, we were able to go back and convince everybody that this was a dumb thing to do and that you really do need. You talk about computers today and the ubiquitousness of computer operations and so on, and you had nobody that was putting up any money to study the human-computer interface problems. And so by using some of those, we were able to get that back. And so you've got those sorts of discontinuities and hiccups that take place from one to another, depending upon their point of view. The interaction with the Bush administration was relatively positive from my point of view. Bromley really wanted to move that agenda, and he moved it in a very difficult time. I think he did very well under circumstances. And then, of course, the Clinton administration started off in the R&D area, you know, just in really good shape and you know, with good understanding of what you needed to do and so on. And they've stuck to it pretty well. They've stuck to it pretty well. And it's been tough to do that because, it's been just a frontal attack in 1994. Now, that has sort of ceased, and everybody is now back to where, yes, R&D is a good thing, but, you know, and that's fine, but now I want a priority, and I don't have that yet. But they all had their different styles, and they all had different mindsets. And in many ways, the people who were science advisors for them made a difference as to how these things went as well, because in no case were those people science people. What's the guy's name who was president of the NAS after that, who was Carter's science advisor, is really a hardcore R&D person. And particularly a research person. I mean, he's and then Reagan brought in that guy from Los Alamos, who was a very conservative Republican, and that's the one who really thought that social sciences and that sort of thing were not there. And then, of course, Bromley, who was the science advisor for Bush, was a plus, and I think Gibbons on balance has been a plus. I think the science advisor in many has a lot of impact on how these things go with respect to the R&D and the interaction with the places like NSF and other R&D agencies.
In a newspaper feature article in Arkansas newspaper about you, among other things included was what was identified as a self-portrait by you, in which, among other things, you identified was your favorite president, which was Washington.
Yep.
But then your fantasy dinner party included among the four presidents that gave you appointments in Washington, only President Clinton is your fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
what was the reason for the dinner party?
Oh, that's easy, because he is one of the most interesting people and one of the most intellectually talented that I've ever met, and he has an interest in a lot of things and can discuss issues at great depth of, I mean, really philosophical kinds of issues at great depth, and he's very articulate, and he's just fun to talk to. It's not that that he has that if you were to rank him, as time goes on and you rank quality of presidents, who knows? But in terms of being able to engage in a challenging discussion on the kinds of topics that you might be interested in, I think he's just almost unbeatable.
The fact that you are now out of government service, have retired into a very active role with venture capital investment.
Right.
I would like for you to comment on what prompted you to retire from the government post, where you seem to be exercising considerable impact. It surely was not because you were tired of working. You're here in a prominent office in Little Rock.
Well, that's true, except that I probably was tired of working 15 hours a day. But two reasons. One is I had promised my family I would stay one full term, and I did that. We had bought a retirement home here 7 or 8 years ago. And, it gets to the point where it's time to do that. That essentially was what I thought, because another 4 years would have been pretty far down the road. We had done a lot of remodeling on the house here. It was just time to do that. That's hard to define exactly why not. The other issue is that, jobs that are as intense as those are, and I guess that's my own fault, okay. But, if you do them as intently, I don't seem to have any capability of handling them any other way, which is probably a mistake. But jobs that are that intense, four or five years is probably the best time, frankly, because you do sort of run out of